Grammy Award-winning composer and Cedar Rapids native Michael Dougherty is back in the state for workshopping American Gothic with Danny Gallion and the UNI Wind Ensemble. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom for IPR's Iowa Art Showcase, and we are so fortunate to have joining us today Michael Dougherty. And welcome to Iowa Public Radio, and congratulations on your three Grammys.
Thank you very much.
So please outline the three Grammys you've received, and I'm beginning to think you probably are going to need a larger trophy case at home.
So actually, the way it worked out is that in 2011, a recording I did of Metropolis Symphony and Deus Ex Machina with National Symphony received three Grammys. Now, I actually, the composer, the only way you can receive a Grammy is if it's selected as the outstanding contemporary classical music composition. So even though a CD might win best CD of the year and it's all your music, as the composer, ironically, you don't actually get a trophy, which is kind of weird. But I was very fortunate in 2011 that it received three Grammys, the recording, and one of those was for classical, the composition. And then in 2017, The Tales of Hemingway, again, another recording with Nashville, and that also received three Grammys, and I also received a Grammy for the outstanding composition. So lightning struck twice, and, you know, I was very grateful for that. Wasn't expecting it, but it was a nice thing.
Well, congratulations, and we're really proud of you, Michael. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
I had a pretty normal upbringing in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'm the oldest of five brothers. We all played music. We had a rock band together called the Soul Company when I was in high school, and we toured around playing small towns, playing proms and homecomings and so forth. I played piano in the concert choir, and I pretty much taught myself jazz piano by checking out records from the Cedar Rapids Library, Thelonious Monk especially. I'd listen to the recordings, because at that time there was no real sheet music you could purchase like there is today. So I would listen to these recordings to try to figure out what these people were doing on the piano, you know. And so I learned to play by ear, and I think that helped me as a composer later on. I also, as a young kid, took art lessons at the Cedar Rapids Public Library, painting especially. And in the room that we learned painting, I was probably like 10 years old or so, was one of the famous Grant Wood paintings, Woman with Plant, which is now, I'm sure, in a museum, but they actually had it hanging on the wall at the time. And Grant Wood actually didn't live far away from where I lived in Cedar Rapids. So visual arts was something I always liked. I got in trouble all the time in junior high school for drawing cartoons during class. You know, I was very good at drawing caricatures of the teachers. I remember I got caught once for doing that. But I was a very visual guy. So drawing, but also just playing music. Another fun thing I did is my senior year in high school, I was tapped to be the pianist for the Dale Thomas Show. Dale Thomas was a country and western personality, very good. And there was a half an hour show once a week called the Dale Thomas Show, and they played like country and western music. So I learned country and western piano. So just right away as a young person, I had a real diversity of playing jazz, rock, country and western music, you know, growing up around that. Cedar Rapids was just so much music, you know, and public schools were great and so forth. So I had a really good upbringing as a kid in growing up in Iowa.
And you went on to the University of North Texas and the Manhattan School of Music. And tell us about some of the people that you worked with along the way.
Sure. Well, the reason I went to North Texas State, which is in Denton, Texas, is now called the University of North Texas, was because at the time in 1972, there were really only two schools that taught jazz in college. One was Indiana University in North Texas, and Berklee School of Music of Boston had just started that year. So again, jazz was, in academia was kind of a new, radical sort of thing. But I went to North Texas, and even though I did jazz, I became more and more interested in orchestra music after hearing the Dallas Symphony play the Samuel Barber Piano Concerto, especially. I remember like, wow, that's pretty amazing. And so I really became interested in the orchestra and writing concert music. And that led me then to New York, you know, where I studied at the Manhattan School of Music and was simultaneously an usher at Carnegie Hall, where I got to hear, you know, for 2 years, the greatest music personalities in the world, you know, the greatest works of the Berlin Philharmonic. Saw Leonard Bernstein conduct many times, Herbert von Karajan, Horowitz play his final concert, Frank Sinatra's retirement concert. I remember I was at the side door of Carnegie Hall. That was my job, and I was probably 10 foot from the stage with Sinatra right there. So great memories of growing up in New York and all these personalities. Pierre Boulez was conducting the New York Philharmonic, and I, you know, being kind of a naive young guy, just went backstage one time to Pierre Boulez and said, you know, he was also a composer, you know, Pierre Boulez, and said, gee, I'd really like to come to France, because he was starting a new composers institute in Paris. And so he scribbled down, well, contact this person. And so I actually wrote them in Paris and he wrote back, and I applied for Fulbright and ended up in Paris, just like Grant Wood did, you know, went to Paris to study as an artist as a young kid. So here I was in Paris with a pretty bad French, you know, but thrown into the world of European avant-garde music. And that was a really fascinating experience, being in a different culture. Went back to Yale, and that's where I was able to work with a lot of famous composers like Jacob Druckmann and others. And then I also was very lucky to be the jazz assistant to Gil Evans, the famous jazz arranger who worked with Miles Davis. And then finally I ended up working a couple years with Giorgi Ligeti in Hamburg, who's probably, you know, arguably one of the most famous composers of the 20th century. So I was very lucky to work in a lot of great personalities and have a lot of great experiences.
And since then, you've gone on to teach at Oberlin, and you're currently teaching in Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I taught at Oberlin for 5 years. Well, I should tell a story. So after I'd done all these studies, I was probably in my late 20s and recently married. My wife was going to Princeton University to do a doctorate in comparative literature. And here I was, you know, with no job. I mean, nothing, you know. So, like, what am I going to do? So I kind of went back to my roots and ended up playing, like, lounge piano in hotels in New Jersey, you know, and playing jazz gigs occasionally. I remember playing in some mafia Italian restaurants in Trenton, New Jersey, you know. Very interesting time. But I kept writing music and was very lucky to land a job as a young professor at Oberlin Conservatory, which is a very tiny town. I mean, it's, you know, like Mount Vernon, Iowa, a town like that, with a great famous music school. So here I was, you know, starting out, and what am I going to do? And so I eventually, you know, really decided to reflect on who I was, and I wanted to write something really American. So that's when I started to think about American icons, and that led to, at that time, you know, my first major piece, the Metropolis Symphony, inspired by the Superman comics. Then I turned to Elvis, Dead Elvis, and La Tumba de Liberace, and then Jackie O and Jackie Kennedy. And I just kept exploring that, and then places like Route 66 and so forth. So I writing, and then I ended up at Michigan, University of Michigan, where I've been since 1991. And in, you know, that song by Frank Sinatra, it was a very good year, you know, when I was 17, and now I'm in the twilight of my years, you know, and so I'm in my final years here, turning 65, hard to believe, my final years at Michigan. And so it's been, I've been there for 28 years now. So it's been a great experience working with a lot of very talented composers.
Well, tell us how you got started on this Tales of Hemingway.
Sure. Well, Tales of Hemingway for cello and orchestra, the way that came about was after, I've been very fortunate to have that recording with National Symphony, the Metropolis Symphony that won the Grammys. The conductor, John Carlo Guerrero, asked me, well, we should do another project down the line. What would you like to do? And I had not written a cello concerto yet. So I thought I'd really like to write, you know, a cello concerto. And so I thought about it for a while, and I'd always been a big fan of Hemingway. And when I discovered that Hemingway played the cello as a kid, I thought, that's kind of an interesting connection. So then I went to Chicago to the Hemingway house, and I went up to northern Michigan, where Hemingway spent a lot of time, actually up by Charlevoix, Michigan, way up in northern Michigan, where his family went when he was a kid. And also that's where he wrote his short stories after he was wounded in the First World War. He came back to Michigan, lived up north, and wrote The Big Two-Hearted River, his famous short story. So, and as a kid in Cedar Rapids, you know, I had read Hemingway and used to check out books in the library as a kid, and some Hemingway books. So it all kind of came together with Tales of Hemingway.
And you somehow got into, you decided to pick four Hemingway works to be part of this Tales of Hemingway, a concerto for cello and orchestra.
Yeah, well, part of it, you know, is, I mean, in all my music, I have to have a concept or an idea of some sort. I have to know what the piece is going to be about, what is it emotionally, you know, the framework that I want to do. So it just helps me compose. Just to write a cello concerto that's very abstract to me, I just can't, that just doesn't work for me. But to have, like, you know, it's like an actor. I need a script. I need a director. I need to know what the subject matter is. And then I, like a method actor, I then do research on whatever that the thing is. So in this case, it was Hemingway. 2 weeks from now, I have a world premiere with the Pacific Symphony to the New World, inspired by the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. So for that, I did a lot of research about Apollo 11 and went to the Neil Armstrong Museum in Ohio. And so that's what I do. I do a lot of research, and it gives me ideas. And then I uncover interesting things, like in the Apollo 11, that Neil Armstrong took some music with him on his flight to the moon, a cassette tape of the New World Symphony of Dvorak. He liked that piece. So I decided, oh, okay, I'll use snippets of that piece, of the Dvorak, in my homage to the Apollo 11. So through research, you find interesting ideas. And also through Hemingway, just rereading some of the novels and just realizing this incredible dramatic life, not only what he wrote, but also what he lived. I mean, this was this hard-driving, hard-drinking adventurer who, you know, always liked to be in the hottest spot of the world. And if it was the Spanish Civil War of the 30s, he was on the beaches of D-Day in World War II as a reporter. You know, he liked to be in danger. He was in 3 plane crashes, barely survived. And, you know, this idea of his idea of courage, you know, it's old fashioned in a way, but, you know, just Hemingway had these certain ways of writing. And I wanted to translate that into music. And so that's how that came about. And so shall we say what the 4 movements
yes,
are?
Yes. Start with the first one, the big two-hearted river.
Yeah. So that's where Hemingway, like I said, as a kid and after the First World War, he went to northern Michigan to convalesce after he was wounded. And that's where he really started to do his writing. And the big two-hearted river was, you know, the famous novel about how nature can heal oneself. And then the second movement, For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, the famous novel about a school teacher who joins the rebels of the Spanish Civil War, fighting the fascists, and as Hemingway did himself and was a reporter during that time, and, you know, has a tragic ending. The Old Man and the Sea, the book for which he won the Nobel Prize in Literature, it's a very short novel about an old man who is a fisherman in Cuba who just can't seem to catch any fish, so he's kind of bad luck, and everybody shuns him except for this young boy who encourages him to go out one last time to try to catch that big fish. And he goes out and does catch the big fish, but then on the way back, it's eaten by the sharks. And it's kind of a strange story because you don't really know, is this a tragic story or is it a redeeming story? There are a lot of question marks about it, but it inspired me to write this movement to The Old Man and the Sea, which has really a great tune, I think, and some very guilty pleasure moments as well. And The Sun also Rises, that gave me an excuse to write some bullfighting music. I'm not a fan of bullfighting, but Hemingway was obsessed with bullfighting for some reason and went to Spain all the time. And he actually wrote a book about bullfighting and bullfighters. And so that was the dramatic framework for the last movement, and which starts out with the cello playing like a flamenco guitar, which is kind of interesting. And then has a huge pull out the stops ending. So I've been very thrilled by, you know, the reception of the piece. And Azul Billy's played it here and abroad. And some other cellists are starting to play it as well. And it's been played about 70 times so far, the work, which is pretty good for a new piece, you know, especially a contemporary work. And I know Zool's playing it many times next season as well. So that's good.
And Zool is a phenomenal cellist, so having him take the solo part is really exciting.
Yeah, well, Zool Bailey, he's a young, charismatic guy. He's got a lot of energy. I don't know how he does it, but he's constantly on the road. I think he's on the road like 300 days a year or something, you know. And, you know, he plays the standard rep, of course, cello concertos, but he really, really believes in this piece, and he has really owns it and has internalized it. Now he's been playing it for a number of years, and his performances are really quite something. And I must say, when he played here at Orchestra Iowa, it was really a memorable one, his performance.
Well, and it's a powerful piece, the way you've written it, and with all the symbolism and different things that you've woven into it, it really makes it very special.
one of the biggest challenges of writing cello concertos is that, you know, there's a group of cello concertos, a very small group that are always played, like the Dvorak and the Tchaikovsky and so forth. So to write a piece that could even crack those, you know, get into that ring, so to speak, with those is very, very difficult. But this piece seems to resonate with audiences, and, you know, I'm just very pleased with how it's been received.
So is there anything else you'd like to say about the Tales of Hemingway and your piece being played by Orchestra Iowa here in Iowa?
Well, it's always a great pleasure to come back to Iowa because I have such fond memories of growing up in Cedar Rapids. You know, it's funny. I go back to my high school reunions. Now, I know people who would never go back to a high school reunion. You know, they don't have pleasant memories of their past or something, or they don't want to see people from 20 years ago. I'm very different in that aspect. I like to keep a link to history and to my past. That's very important to me, and memories. And that's part of what my music's about. It's about memory. It's about making linkages of history and personalities. And I'm nostalgic, I guess, to a certain degree. But I love to look at, when I go to any town, like one of my favorite things to do, actually, is to drive to northeastern Iowa by the Mississippi River, McGregor and Elkhart, Iowa, which has Turkey River, which has an amazing antique store, which I like to go to. But, you know, these rolling kind of hills, like in a Grant Wood painting, you know, I just love that's part of Iowa. So road trips are very important to me. And when I come to Iowa, I like to drive to Stone City, you know, where Grant Wood painted the famous painting. So driving through Iowa, I like coming back and but just thinking about all the memories and all the people I knew. And, you know, it's always just a great pleasure to be back in Iowa. And I believe they're playing a tuba concerto that I wrote next season called Reflections on the Mississippi for tuba and orchestra, which is a piece dedicated to my late father. So I believe they're doing that next season. And, Cedar Rapids is a great town, and I just wish they hadn't torn down so many buildings. You know, I always lament that there was an amazing train station, Victorian train station, they tore down in, like, in the 60s to build a parking lot. I mean, of course, today you would never do that, but they tore down about half of the downtown in the 60s, which is really a shame. Now, of course, they would never do that, and they're renovating Cedar Rapids, and you have a lovely downtown here in Cedar Falls, too, an old downtown in Waterloo. So, yeah, it's great.
Thanks for today's interview goes to IPR's Chris Fenton and Alexis Hahn, and a big thanks to Grammy Award-winning composer and Cedar Rapids native Michael Doherty. And thanks again for joining us today, and best wishes in your compositional career.
My pleasure, and we'll see you next time.